This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. Today on the show, a UN treaty banning nuclear weapons is set to enter into force in January after being ratified by 90 countries, including Pacific Island countries. You'll hear from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons about what impact this treaty might have, coming up in around 20 minutes. And fans around PNG have continued celebrating Melbourne Storm player Justin Olam's performance in the NRL Grand Final at the weekend. Coming up in about 5 minutes, you'll hear how the 26-year-old rugby league player has inspired fans across the country. But first, a plane crash investigation in Vanuatu.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
An investigation into an accident involving an Air Vanuatu flight is critical of the airline's emergency training procedures for pilots and cabin crew. The plane crashed into two other aircraft parked at Port Vila's airport 2 years ago after an emergency landing caused by malfunctioning engine and a smoke-filled cabin. Liam Fox is following the developments for Pacific Beat. Liam, take us back and tell us more about what happened 2 years ago.
Well, it must have been a terrifying ordeal for the passengers and crew on board the Air Vanuatu flight from Tanna to Port Vila back in July 2018. About halfway into the flight, they heard loud banging noises coming from the right-hand side of the ATR-72-500. Then the cabin filled up with smoke. The pilot in command shut down one of the two engines and landed the plane, but that wasn't the end of it. After touching down, the plane veered left off the runway into two stationary planes, causing significant damage to all three aircraft. Fortunately, none of the 39 passengers or four crew were injured. In a local news report at the time, passengers were quoted as saying they thought they were going to die, but they did praise the actions of the pilot. But air accident investigators have delivered a report that's critical of the pilots, crew, and airline.
And so what did investigators find caused the accident?
The incident was investigated by Papua New Guinea's Accident Investigation Commission because aviation authorities in Vanuatu don't have the manpower or expertise to carry out such investigations. Its report was released last year, but to use an aviation pun, it's flown under the radar until now, possibly because it was conducted by PNG investigators and then released on the PNG Accident Investigation website. Its report paints a picture of panic and confusion in the cockpit as the pilot and co-pilot scrambled to respond to a faulty engine, smoke in the cabin, and multiple other warnings by reading various operational checklists. The pilots turned off both generators in line with one of those checklists, which meant the main wheel brakes and nose wheel steering were not available when the plane landed. They also turned off one of the two engines as it came into land. The flight crew reported that after landing, they couldn't control or stop the aircraft. The report said the emergency brake was available, but there was no evidence to show it had been applied. It found the engine malfunction caused the smoke but did not cause the accident, as pilots are trained to land multi-engine aircraft with an engine inoperative. The report was also critical of the cabin crew. It found they did not don their protective breathing equipment, they did not carry out standard procedures like handing passengers wet towels to help them breathe, nor did they inform the pilot of the density, colour and source of the smoke. They were also unaware of Air Vanuatu's smoke emergency procedure. The pilot in command was experienced, but training records showed his smoke control and removal techniques had not been tested since 2015. The co-pilot was inexperienced, and the report said that led the pilot to take on most of the tasks that would normally be shared during an emergency. It concluded that the crew's, quote, inadequate aircraft systems knowledge, skill level and situational awareness contributed to the accident on the ground. The airline itself also copped criticism. Emergency training and training requirements for the crew were inadequate.
And so, Liam, what happens now?
Well, the PNG Accident Investigation Commission made a number of recommendations in line with what its investigators found. Two relate to the aircraft manufacturer and call for clearer emergency checklists. And there were two recommendations for Air Vanuatu. One, that it should ensure cabin crew are adequately trained for smoke emergency procedures, and the other to make sure flight crew are trained, current and competent in handling the same scenarios. Air Vanuatu was asked to provide a response within 90 days outlining what actions it has taken. We've approached Air Vanuatu to ask that same question and we're waiting for a response.
That was Pacific Beat reporter Liam Fox there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, rugby league mad Papua New Guinea has a new hero in Melbourne Storm's Justin Ollam, having earned his spot in the history books by becoming just the fourth PNG player to be part of a winning NRL Grand Final team. A kid from a remote village who grew up playing with a soft drink bottle filled with grass, he's now 26 years old and has become a true role model, providing inspiration through his achievements both in sport and in education with his degree in applied physics. Fans from around the country were full of excitement and pride over Storm's victory in Sydney, and they celebrated Ollam's performance after he scored his team's opening try. One fan, Harry, says he could hear the excitement from his house.
At our house, there was a lot of noise. We felt really special because some of us were really young when Marcus Bai played for the same team and was in the grand final. As the second Papua New Guinean to make it on the big stage, it was a truly big blessing for every Papua New Guinean.
It was truly a big blessing, straight law. People are all one all Papua New Guinean.
Another fan, Trisha Bai, has only pride and happiness after Ollam's winning performance.
Watching him and knowing that one Papua New Guinean.
Watching him knowing that a Papua New Guinean played in the NRL and now won a premiership, I'm so happy. I'm so proud. This is an achievement for every Papua New Guinean.
But Justin's biggest fans are, of course, his parents, Mark and Evelyn Ollam, who live in Gon Village in PNG's remote highlands. They're extremely proud of their son and grateful for the opportunities he's been given. They have strong religious beliefs and spoke briefly with Justin on Grand Final Day and prayed with him over the phone.
Me watching game blow, Justin Ollam.
Evelyn Ollam here saying, maybe God has a plan for the life of this child and that is the reason why I gave birth to him. I'm so happy that he has helped give PNG a good name and rugby league. From my observation, I feel God has a plan for my son and I'm happy for him because he has shown humility and listens carefully and that's why this has happened in his life. And Justin Ollam's performance has also been praised back here in Australia. Former Kumuls captain Mark Mom is now the Pacific Program Coordinator for the NRL in Brisbane. He says the Storm's win and Justin Ollam's performance made him proud as a Papua New Guinean.
Not only was his grand final performance solid and inspirational for his team and himself, but the lead-up games that he played, he just played outstanding rugby league. We were, as Papua New Guineans, always supporting Justin and just really happy for him.
But he says that Justin serves as just one example of the talent in PNG and more needs to be done to create pathways in-country to support emerging rugby league players.
In terms of an elite pathway, Justin has come through the Digicel Cup onto the Hunters and then into an Australian system. So there's evidence there that a pathway exists and works. I think there needs to be work in a pathway for the pathway development in country, in Papua New Guinea itself. I don't think there's enough that's being done there to create, because there's more Justins, I believe, that and more Marcus Byers that are in existence in Papua New Guinea and around the Pacific. So I think there's harder work to be done by the in-country body in Papua New Guinea to there's what looks like a pathway, but the structures aren't joined together to ensure that it's a smooth pathway. So it was easier for Justin to move through a pathway once he made the Hunters, because the Australian structure is well set up for him to get to. And then once you're on that pathway, it really is up to you and your application. But those pathways back in the Pacific need a whole lot of work by the in-country bodies and business by participants, and so it's a big amount of work that has to happen.
And another PNG fan, Tete Ivarato, agrees with this.
I believe that Australian teams should be looking at the potential of PNG players. They should pick more up because young players have a lot of talent. They just need more exposure, and I'd like to see more investment by the government in rugby development.
What are your thoughts? I'd love to know what you think of Justin Olam's success, but also the idea that more needs to be done in-country to support budding rugby league players. The next Justin Olam, Marcus Bai or Amelia Cook, who made history as the first PNG player to get her hands on a women's NRL Grand Final winner's medal 2 years ago. Send us a message on our Radio Australia Facebook page and join in the conversation.
Life Matters. Weekdays at 9 a.m. on Radio Australia.
Being in isolation is different for everyone, but I'm hearing a lot of home cooking lately. People are asking for recipes, they're looking for inspiration, and they're posting pictures on social media of, frankly, mouthwatering dishes. But even if our culinary skill sets are expanding, what will be the consequences for our local restaurants or takeaway outlets?
I think, you know, when people being given the time to, you know, cook more at home and learn how to cook at home, and then on top of the fact that, you know, the economy's literally in a bit of trouble and money's pretty tight everywhere, they might see a dip in future trade. You know, the average customer that used to come, you know, once or twice a month may now only come once a month. Definitely, I think that it'll be an influx of people as soon as the restrictions get lifted, and I think it will definitely be a bit of a struggle moving forward till the economy stabilises.
Life Matters. Weekdays at 9 a.m. on Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Let's have some music on this Tuesday morning. This is Vance Joy with Saturday Sun.
Oh, Saturday Sun. I met someone out on the West Coast. I gotta get back. I can't let this go. Oh, Saturday Sun. I met someone. Don't care what it costs. No ray of sunlight's ever lost. So tired of sleeping alone, so tired of eating alone. I need to ask her, what's going on? Are we going strong? She felt like rest in her head. My shoulder was the perfect height. We fit so right. So what's going on? Cause I've been undone. The long drive, the coastline, looking at a first light.
That was Vance Joy with his song Saturday Sun. Now it's time to find out all the latest weather news from across the region, and I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Hi, Jordan.
Neville, I hear that there's some weather about in the Cook Islands and Solomon Islands.
Yeah, that's about it, really. We have a very weak tropical system that's out just to the east of Samoa, near the central and northern Cooks. The very isolated atolls out there, not many people out there, so few folks will even know about it, really. But certainly the most populated parts of the Pacific, weather remains pretty much fine, sunny, with large high-pressure system just to the east of New Zealand, sitting there almost stationary now, and it looks like it's going to stay there till at least the weekend. So it's a bit like Groundhog Day. We're repeating the same weather over and over, and but at least it's nice weather, and the farmers might look for a bit of rain in a few days, but for now we'll take this lovely weather while we got it.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely lovely. Like you say, Groundhog Day, but if it's good weather, well, I feel like there's not many complaints about there. Neville, thank you so much for that quick update.
Sure, and just one thing real quick. It looks like you're going to get some more rain over the eastern seaboard this weekend of Australia. This is La Nina pretty much full blown now. It's more tropical moisture coming down through the eastern half of Australia, and that's tied in with the very strong trade winds that we're experiencing over the Pacific. So La Nina is certainly getting to peak intensity right now. So, you know, for folks around the Coral Sea and along the east coast of Australia, look out.
Yeah, definitely that wet weather. Look, not something I'm particularly happy about. I was hoping that obviously here in Melbourne, we've just come out of, we're coming out of lockdown with easing restrictions, and I was hoping for a lot of sun, but what can you do? That's the weather.
Yeah, you take what you get.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Neville.
Okay, no worries.
That was Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. They're bringing us weather updates from across the region. Now to find out all the latest news and updates from across the region there, and to do that, I'm joined by Richard Hewitt. Good morning, Richard.
Morning, Jordan.
Richard, first to the COVID-19 picture in the Pacific with news from Guam and Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, PNG first, and the National Control Centre in Port Moresby says a team of laboratory and clinical management specialists has been deployed to the Eastern Highlands to support the health authorities there to intensify their COVID-19 preparedness. Representatives from the National Department of Health, the Central Public Health Laboratory and the World Health Organization have visited the Eastern Highlands Provincial Hospital to discuss pre-triage systems, patient pathways, also isolation facilities for coronavirus patients. The National Pandemic Response Controller, Police Commissioner David Manning, he says the threat of COVID-19 remains in Papua New Guinea, and we need, he says, to continue to scale up our preparedness in all provinces. That same team, incidentally, that went to the Eastern Highlands has also visited the PNG Institute for Medical Research to discuss laboratory testing for COVID-19 and how the National Control Centre can provide further support for the diagnostic services the Institute is offering to the entire country. In terms of numbers, no COVID-19 case has been reported in PNG over the past 48 hours, so that's good news. The total still stands at 588 cases, 7 fatalities so far. 92 samples are pending laboratory results. The picture, though, somewhat bleaker in Guam, where nearly 200 new cases have been reported, covering 3 days between October the 23rd and October the 25th. In addition, there have been 3 fatalities involving a man and a woman in their 70s and a man in his late 80s. All are said to have had underlying health conditions. The total number of COVID-19 cases in the US territory is approaching 4,400, and the number of deaths stands at 75.
Now to some news out of Vanuatu and a new initiative in Vanuatu backed by the UN and the European Union designed to tackle the alarming rates of violence against women and girls. What do we know there?
Well, the figures are disturbing, that's for sure. Vanuatu continues to have the highest prevalence rates of violence against women and girls globally, with 60% of New Vanuatu women aged between 15 and 49 having experienced physical or sexual violence, or in some cases, both. The prevalence of sexual abuse against girls under the age of 15 stands at almost 30%, is also one of the highest in the world. For more than 1 in 4 women in Vanuatu, 28% in fact, their first sexual experience is forced. So now the Spotlight Initiative Country Programme has been launched in Vanuatu, 450 million Vatu in funding. That's around $5.5 million. It's part of a global initiative to shine a spotlight on violence against females by targeting 6 key areas: policy and law, institutions, prevention, services, data and civil society. In launching the initiative, the Prime Minister Bob Lofman said violence against women and girls is not normal and is unacceptable. The government of Vanuatu, he says, is committed to preventing and eliminating all forms of violence and discrimination against women, children and vulnerable groups under the National Sustainable Development Plan. And the United Nations resident coordinator, Sanaka Samarasinha, added that the Spotlight Initiative needs to make a tangible difference in the lives of women and girls over the next 2 years. We will be accountable for bringing all parts of the UN together to support government and civil society.
Yeah, those statistics you read out there, quite disturbing. So it would be great to see how this initiative takes hold and whether, yeah, any differences are made there. Finally, to the last piece of news, the ongoing stoush over who should be the next Secretary General of the Pacific Islands Forum continues to rumble on, with another warning from Palau's President Tommy Remengesau Jr.
Yeah, and it's a stark warning to say the least, with President Remengesau, backed by the other Micronesian leaders, saying if a gentleman's agreement is not honoured and Micronesia's candidate Gerald Zakios from Marshall Islands is not appointed to succeed Dame Meg Taylor in the top job, then it would be a joke for the Micronesian countries to remain in the forum. Mr. Rebecca South has told the Island Times there would no longer be any value in being part of the forum if their wishes were not heard. Now, Papua New Guinea's Dame Meg Taylor has led the forum since 2014. She's set to end her term this year, but due to the COVID-19 pandemic, leaders are yet to meet to choose her replacement. Now, a virtual leaders summit is being arranged to take place before the end of the year, with the original gathering face-to-face. Of course, it would have been in Vanuatu having been cancelled. So at that point, you would expect the leadership question to be resolved. But with four of the candidates in the mix, a solution may not be easy to find. One of those candidates, for example, Henry Puna, recently stepped down as Cook Islands Prime Minister. So clearly he's intent on pursuing his goal of taking up the reins at the forum. And he and his supporters, I suspect, won't go down without a fight. And the other contenders are also highly credentialed. We have Dr. Jimmy Rogers, currently key advisor to Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manase Sogavare. Tonga's Amelia Kinahawa Siamomo, who's head of the gender section at the Commonwealth Secretariat. And Fiji's candidate, Ratu Enoki Kumabola, has served as a minister in several governments, some elected, others unelected, and as foreign affairs minister in the Fiji First Government. He represented his country for a while at the forum. That was during the period when Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama was still refusing to attend.
So lots of credentials there in all the people putting their hand up, and something we'll definitely keep across here at Pacific Beat. Richard, thank you so much for bringing us those updates.
No problem.
That was Pacific Beat reporter Richard Hewitt with all the latest news wrap there.
Maintaining a safe distance between yourself and others is very important to slow the spread of coronavirus. When saying hello and goodbye to people you meet, it's important not to shake hands, hug, or kiss. A safer way to greet people is to simply wave and smile without touching. If you are interacting with someone who is coughing or sneezing, you should avoid physical contact entirely and stay 1.5 meters away from them. This will reduce the chance of spreading the virus.
Let's have a bit more music here on Pacific Beat. This is Bobby Alu with Tangi.
Tangi alume, tangi awe, lume, 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 lume.
Alu there with his song Tangi.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. The international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons was founded in Melbourne just 13 years ago. But now ICAN, as it's known, has non-government organisations on board in 100 countries. 3 years ago, the Anti-Nuclear Coalition was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and now another landmark in its campaign to rid the world of nuclear arms has been reached with the ratification of the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. When Honduras in Central America became the 50th country to ratify at the weekend, triggering a 90-day countdown to the treaty becoming international law on January 22nd. The Pacific has played a big part in getting the agreement to this stage, with one in five of those countries that have ratified being island nations. But what impact will the treaty actually have once it becomes law? We're joined by Dr. Vanessa Griffin, who during her student days in Fiji was a founder member of NFIP, Nuclear Free and Independent Pacific, and now she's a leading activist with ICAN. Dr. Griffin, good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Dr. Griffin, this UN treaty has been painted in some circles as symbolic. So in practical terms, what impact do you think it will have on the campaign to get rid of nuclear weapons?
Well, of course, I don't think it's symbolic at all. Usually you would say something symbolic if it's really a token representation of something. But this is actually a treaty which many states, of course, adopted and many have now ratified. And it literally, as you've described, will come into force. So that's not symbolic at all. And when a treaty does come into force, you actually have all the states who have committed to it obliged to follow it, and they will. But also, it just becomes international law, and that is the norm, that nuclear weapons are declared prohibited. And I don't find that symbolic at all. It's really something very powerful to go by for the international community and for the many countries and peoples and activists that have worked really 75 years to get to this point.
You were saying that the states that have ratified this treaty, obviously they will have to follow along with what they've ratified. Do you think that this treaty, though, will influence states that haven't ratified the treaty or signed on?
It does influence them in the sense it's now a treaty that is part of the nuclear disarmament process, along with other treaties. And whether states have ratified this treaty or not, you still have the international law being established that the weapons are prohibited, and then the many articles around that of are declared illegal. So it's producing these weapons and so on. And even the many investments we are not aware of, the money that goes into nuclear weapons, all of those are then held under the banner of, you know, you are investing in a prohibited weapon. And so I think there are many other influences that can and will happen as a result of this treaty. And of course, there are some positive obligations, including around victims assistance and environmental remediation, which will be very important for countries like the Pacific that have gone through so much of the impacts of nuclear testing of these weapons.
Yeah, as you mentioned there, the impact on the Pacific nations, 10 of the 50 countries that have ratified are from the Pacific, including your own Fiji. What does this treaty mean to those island nations?
I think throughout the process, it's enabled the Pacific countries to express their attitude to nuclear weapons, because they've experienced in the region, whether directly as being sites of nuclear testing, or the Pacific Islands' unique solidarity with everyone in the region, every country that experienced the weapons. So it's been a way of expressing that very concretely. And yes, we are, you know, such a high percentage of the countries that enabled this treaty to come into force. But more than that, we have the lingering, continuing impacts of nuclear testing. And in that sense, I was just thinking about it, that under Article 6 on victims' assistance and environmental remediation, this will allow us surely to have a chance to collectively, not just as the Pacific Islands, but with the other countries and peoples that have experienced nuclear testing and the impacts of the weapons, which is, you know, Japan suffering the atomic bombs being actually used on them. You have an allowance now of time to look at how do you assist victims of these nuclear weapons, and how do you also address environmental remediation? And I think the Pacific countries, the Marshall Islands, Maui Nui, French Polynesia, they literally are observing and having right next to them the possible leakage of nuclear waste from the testing into the environment. And the rest of the Pacific is also joining them in concern about that. So it just allows us to do now assessments of, you know, what the situation is. I was just thinking about it. It allows a collective thinking on victims' assistance and being able to work together. And knowing you have the international community and an international legal instrument there, which can help focus, you know, actions to be taken and have a wider world paying attention to these impacts. So I find that very powerful and forward-looking. And it helps it helps look at the current state of victim assistance. What is the current state, and how have our Pacific Islanders fared? And again, you just have this different arena being opened up for looking at what can be done on the health impacts and then the environmental impacts of nuclear testing in our Pacific Islands.
Mm. And so this treaty becomes law in 3 months' time. How long do you think it will be now before Australia signs up and ratifies?
It's the work being done by ICANN Australia and by many other, you know, activists and members of so many different organizations has been extremely promising. And when the treaty reached its 50th ratification, you had the leader of the current opposition and the shadow foreign minister actually declaring, that's the Labour Party, actually declaring they would come and actually support the treaty if they were in power. So that is just one small but significant example. But you have many actions that have been done here to clearly show the popular support, as in non-bipartisan and many facets of Australians supporting this treaty. So I think we just need a change of systems of government to have Australia support this treaty. We hope it will happen.
And Dr. Griffin, for you personally, after more than 40 years of campaigning on the anti-nuclear question, would you say the end game, getting rid of nuclear weapons, is actually in sight?
What should be made clear is this will take time, and what we have now is a means of getting there. It is in sight in the sense, you know, even as you've campaigned a very long time, and even as we've advocated the treaty to have this 50th ratification and entry into force, is really the movement forward. What happens will be meetings of states on this. It triggers implementation discussion. So there's very concrete forms in which this treaty now will be examined. How do we implement this? What is the procedure? And so on. And that will be ongoing. So the abolition, you know, and the elimination doesn't happen immediately, but you really have now an international process that will take place in 5 years' time. There will be a review of the treaty and its operation, you know, and every 6 years after that, a review of progress being made. So, you know, all the states parties will now be working together on that. And in 1 year's time, we literally will have a first meeting, which will say, you know, how are decisions going to be made? How is the treaty going to be implemented? So I just think they're very practical, concrete, and decided procedures that will now, you know, begin to happen. And that's really, really promising and allows a lot more work to be done.
I'm sure a lot of countries looking forward to that one-year meeting to see what comes of this ratification. Dr. Vanessa Griffin, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thanks very much. Okay, bye-bye.
That was Dr. Vanessa Griffin, who is one of the leading activists, with ICANN speaking to us there.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Rising sea levels are widely accepted as the greatest challenge facing low-lying atolls in the Pacific, but there's another crisis playing out for the citizens of these vulnerable nations. Their health is being dangerously compromised by a decline in traditional farming systems linked to climate change, but also to modernised economies. But there may be a glimmer of hope thanks to the latest research that's led to better local food production. To find out more, Susie Rains has been speaking to Dr. James Quilty from the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research about the work his team has been doing in Kiribati and Tuvalu.
The atolls are, as you can imagine, they're basically coral. So they're crushed coral, which forms as sand, and they're very low in nutrients. You don't see many plants growing on a beach, and you certainly don't see green leafy vegetables growing on a beach. There's almost no iron at all in the soil, and iron is an essential nutrient for crop production. And because the population's expanding, is growing in the atolls, the food production has not kept up with population growth, and it just can't. Under traditional systems.
So as the quality of the soil has declined, so too have the diets of people in these countries?
Fertility of the soil was always incredibly poor in the atolls, but the production systems there were subsistent. So they were very low intensity. They were only producing enough food for a fairly small population, and there was a big reliance on seafood. The amount of seafood eating per capita, I believe, has declined, and the amount of, for example, spam has increased in the diet. Spam is very popular in the atolls.
What is the health of these populations like? How is that sort of showing up in a medical sense?
They have some of the highest rates of non-communicable diseases in the world. Obesity is a major problem. Diabetes is a major problem. They have very high sugar, very high fat diets, and it probably is going to take a generational change to influence diets. So trying to get information on healthy diets into schools is really critical.
You've been trying to find ways to grow better food there. Tell us about some of your discoveries.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. We've been trying to figure out within the resource base of the atolls how we can better grow healthy vegetables. A lot of the vegetation used to be part of the diet, so it's sort of a forgotten food source within the islands, and that some of that is very nutritious, but it's no longer eaten. By taking basically a recipe of the different biomasses available, mixing them at certain ratios, you can produce a compost that meets most of the crop requirements.
And you've been working with some local farmers too. What's been reaction from the communities?
Because the people who live on the atolls were all fishermen, and then they grew a small amount of vegetables in traditional systems to supplement that. Bringing in these new technologies is really the method of growing the food is really a change that's to tradition. Yeah, so it's actually quite challenging to change people's worldview of who they are. So that's something that we're still working on. It's trying to understand how can we help them see themselves as farmers or you know, food producers, land-based food producers rather than fisher folk.
What sort of vegetables are doing well with this soil that you've improved?
I guess the main traditional food that they grow is taro. And taro does grow reasonably well in these composts. But we're also looking at green leafy vegetables and also legumes and so forth. And we're exploring opportunities to overcome those deficiencies. For example, we're looking at putting rusty tin cans into the composting system to see if we can increase the amount of iron in the compost, and also pre-treating the cans to try to stimulate the release of iron into the compost.
Does the cost of vegetables have anything to do with the reluctance on the part of the population there to eat healthier food?
Yes, absolutely it does. The cost and the availability are probably the two massive barriers to improve diets. The cost of a cabbage prior to COVID-19 was around $18. I believe now it's pushing towards $30 for one cabbage. The actual availability of vegetables in the market is so limited that in some circumstances there's a lottery system.
What's the end game here for you?
The thing to consider is that the atolls, as a result of climate change, are predicted to be uninhabitable within 50 years. The end game for me and for ASEA is really about the people, improving the health of the people on the atolls, but also helping develop skills in food production, skills in research, skills in business that they can migrate with. So at some point, very sadly, the population of Tuvalu and Kiribati under climate change is going to have to leave their homeland, which is a horrible thing to think about, really. It must be incredibly challenging. But when you talk to the people of the atolls, they seem to have accepted it and are getting on with life and are such positive people that what we want to do is help them wherever they go in the future, that they have good livelihoods, good diets, good health. So helping them migrate with dignity is incredibly important.
Dr. James Quilty is a research program manager with the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, and he was speaking there to Susie Rains.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, coming up, you're going to hear about a disabled artist with Samoan and Pakeha background who has won the Pacific Toa Artist Award. But first, some music that says Go Farther in Lightness from Gang of Youths.
All the strangest things keep happening all by my father. Old magnolia tree and the Sydney sky is rainless and sings off key, but it's cool in a weird way that I wish I could be. It's the weirdest high and the lowest peak. God, I'm an alien. I'm my own goddamn street. I climb some wall and curse out my favorite team and stare.
That song, just a short one from Gang of Youths. It was Go Farther in Lightness. Short, but so sweet.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
My name's Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Pacifica artists are shining a light on the rich diversity of their culture across Australia and New Zealand, where a growing diaspora community is making its mark. Musicians, dancers, visual artists and storytellers, or creatives as they're known, use their craft to raise visibility and communicate their identity and values. Earlier this month, 8 Pacifica heritage artists were recognised for their contribution to arts at the Arts Pacifica Awards in New Zealand. 24-year-old Pelena Kiki Brown, a disabled artist with Samoan and Pakeha background, was a joint winner of the Pacific Toa Artist Award. Miss Brown is the first artistic director at Touch Compass, a performance company that works with disabled and non-disabled artists in New Zealand. She was recognised for raising the standards, expectations and reputation of Pacific arts and artists. Kelvin Anthony has been speaking to Pelena Kiki Brown to find out why her work is crucial for her community.
My personal practice is thinking about the intersects between Samoan culture and concept and disabled culture and concept. So my work has always been thinking about what does it mean to be growing up within these two cultures, and then how do they connect with my disabled identity and disabled culture.
What inspires you and your work as an artist?
My work, I have a lot of central questions that I'm exploring. A lot of the time it's thinking about the intersections between my background and how that informs my practice. I'm always thinking about the Samoan concept of the va, which is a framework around spatial relationships. So in my drawing and writing and performing practice, I often investigate the spatial relationships occurring, and then I kind of go from there. My work is thinking about lots of different forms. Other artists that inspire me or I look to, because sometimes the word inspiration can be used very heavily towards disabled artists and often in a patronizing way. So I guess artists that I'm more inclined to be influenced by are artists that are straddling multiple identities. They're thinking about things in an interdisciplinary way. There may be, their work is often not able to be classified into an art form. I think that disability culture is very Pākehā, and also in Pasifika culture, there's often not a space for disabled voices. So the work is thinking about where are all those intersections and how can you make space for these multiple communities to meet and relate with each other.
So what does it mean to win this award?
It's huge to be recognised as one of the Pacific Tour Award winners this year. I think because I've been making work internationally for the last 6.5 years, it's really big and important and a huge honour to receive the award and the recognition in Aotearoa and home alongside all the other artists, especially this year. I've been thinking about the keyboard as a site of choreography and a site for disability access and how you can create and choreograph using technology and also thinking about what ancestral knowledge you might find on the keyboard. So I think that was, I was recognized through the mahi that I've been doing, and I guess it's a great time that it also coincided with my new role as someone who's here to support a sector in Aotearoa, and because you never want to make work that you can't come back and share with your communities.
Now, you're the first person with a disability to lead Touch Campus as an artistic director. What does that mean to you personally?
I think it's really important to foster spaces with and for the communities that you work for. I think it's the same if you are working in another company and you don't represent the communities that you work for. So I think that's really important, and there are lots of values in disability justice and disability culture. And one of the founding ones is nothing about us without us. So I don't think you can create a truly accessible culture or community or company environment if you don't have any of those people that you are accountable in your company.
You've exhibited, performed and published in the US, the UK, Germany and Aotearoa. How important is having that global experience and bringing that back to help the Pacific artists in Aotearoa?
I was really lucky to kind of find and develop my artistic voice in New York. I think the landscape is so huge, and the attitudes of Americans that you can do what you would like to do, and maybe in Aotearoa there's less space to explore what you want to do. Especially in New York, there are other disabled artists making work, so I think that's really helpful for me that I have started to grow and be in community with lots of people. I think in New York we're having lots of exciting conversations around disability artistry and what that might look like, and we're not quite having them at the moment in Aotearoa, so it's really exciting for me to help support that and create with the community here.
So what do you plan to do next? Do you have any exciting projects lined up?
Yeah, we're making a work at the moment. It's called Iwainga, which means in between in Māori, and it is asking a mixture of Pasifika and Māori Indigenous artists and disabled artists to explore their experience of time and space. And it's going to be a short film that we will be presenting on December 3rd for International Disabled Persons Day. So I'm really excited to be having these conversations with artists and making this new work.
Great. So that's something to look forward to. Now, finally, what is your message to other Pacific artists who want to do the kind of work that you're doing in this space?
It's quite scary to start. That's sometimes the biggest thing. And a lot of the time we have these secret ideas that we really want to try. And I would just encourage people to start. If you have an idea, try it. We're not going to be successful the first time. So actually you learn a lot from failing. You don't explore those creative sides or try something new. You often are left with a lot of regret and you want to do it. So I think that there are spaces there. I think with the internet, you can often find the community that you're looking for. So I think that's really exciting. And I can see that in the younger artists that they're having conversations and thinking about ideas that took me a couple more years to figure that out, and because they have access to this global community. So I would just encourage other Pasifika artists to maybe start at those ideas or dreams that they have niggling in the back of their mind.
That was Pelena Kiki Brown, a disabled artist with Samoan and Pakeha background, speaking to reporter Kelvin Anthony.
Love sport? Join Rock and Cav every Thursday night across the Pacific.
Can you be more Pacific?
Each week they'll have their own unique take on all things sport.
Ratu Ngolea, what a legend. I'm so proud of that young man.
That guy is on his way to being at the same status as Nick Maitanui, I reckon.
Oh, wow, that's a big call.
Bro, I'm calling it, man.
Thursday nights across the Pacific.
With Sonny Bill, you also get the aura around Sonny Bill.
You know what? That aura you speak of,
yes,
brings the best out of players.
They see a guy that they've looked up to.
And that's their whole life. Difference between Benji Marshall.
Yes.
See, we just unlocked the vault right now.
We ask questions and then we answer them later.
Exactly. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. We've just unlocked
the NRL Da Vinci Code. Rock and Cav, unlocking codes.
Can you be more Pacific? 6 p.m. Thursday nights, PNG time on Radio Australia.
That's the program for this morning. Nick Fogarty will be along at 3 p.m. PNG time for the afternoon edition of Pacific Beat. Stay with us, though, on ABC Radio Australia across the day, or head over to the ABC Radio Australia Facebook page so you can get all the latest developments and breaking news over there. It's also where you can join in the conversation. If you've got any thoughts about the stories from today, from the new ratification of the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or what's being done about traditional farming systems in the Pacific, you can head over there and get in touch or get in conversation and chat with others about it. We're also on Twitter at Radio Australia. That's where you'll find us if you want to tweet at us. And if you want to listen back to any of the stories today, just head over to our website. You can search ABC Pacific Beat into your search engine and you'll find us there. You can also listen to the show live there, online, or of course we're on FM radio across the Pacific. I'm Jordan Fennell. Thanks so much for your company today and have a lovely Tuesday.